Hi, this is John Stone Street, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, which you can find online at breakpoint.org. The Colson Center is pleased to support listening in. Enjoy the program.
I'm Warren Smith, and today you're listening in on my conversation with World News Group senior editor Mindy Bells as we discuss her new book, They Say We Are Infidels.
You can't compartmentalize, and I think that's a really important lesson for all of us, but even for our policymakers, that push-button wars still kill people and still change and affect lives. And so I'm standing on the top of a church, and I'm hearing the F-18s fly over, and I'm realizing that the reality of that for the Iraqis living there is, will I be able to go back to my home? Will I ever be able to put a roof over my kids' heads again in their lives?
Most listeners to this program probably already know Mindy Bells. She's currently senior editor for World News Group in charge of international coverage for the magazine and for the magazine's related digital and audio platforms. But for a decade, she was editor of World Magazine, and she's played a vital role with World since it was founded nearly 30 years ago. She's also the author of a new book, her first, They Say We Are Infidels, is subtitled On the Run from ISIS, with persecuted Christians in the Middle East. It's the story of everyday Christians in the Middle East who, because of the extraordinary circumstances there, have, often against their will even, been thrust into the role of heroes and martyrs. It's also, as we will hear, in part Mindy Bells' own story of growing as a journalist and growing as a believer herself and as a fellow traveler with many of these modern-day heroes of the faith. We had this conversation at the headquarters of World in Asheville, North Carolina. Well, first, Mindy, thank you so much for being on the program. And it feels a little weird, I guess. You know, we're because you were my boss, so to speak, at World for a number of years, 6 or 7 years as the editor. And I was one of the writers. And then, of course, we're having this interview in the World office. And I want to kind of begin maybe there. It's just you've been at World for a long, long time. I mean, World is 30 years old now, right?
Or right.
You had an article in the very first issue of the magazine.
I did.
And you've been an editor of the magazine, the editor of the magazine for 20 plus years, probably around that. Is that accurate? About 20?
No. Actually, 11 years.
You were editor 11 years,
yes.
But you had all kinds of other roles.
I was international editor before that,
yeah.
For 10 years before that.
And I know a little bit about the rhythms of your job, which is, you know, for many years it was a weekly. And then even whenever the magazine, the print version, went to biweekly, there was this daily deadline pressure on the web and all the other moving parts. So I'm not trying to say that you didn't have a good excuse for not writing a book. But, I mean, you went 30 years of your, you know, professional career without writing a book.
That's right.
Why now? Why were you compelled to write this book now?
Well, it was the topic that wouldn't leave me alone. I actually, as I went back through my notes, realized that in about 2005, I was starting to think about writing a book about Iraq's Christians. And at some point, I made an outline. I was going to tell these different stories. These were people I kept going back and checking on. I went into Iraq as a reporter covering a war, like so many others, in 2003, soon after the U.S. invasion. But what I kept going back for was to see what was happening to the Christians and see what was happening to specific ones. And I wanted to tell their stories because I felt like we heard so much about the politics and policies of Iraq and we heard so little about the people. So it wouldn't leave me alone. And then, you know, coming forward to 2014, I went to Baghdad in March of 2014, hoping in a way to put a bookend on the story of what was happening to the churches in Iraq. They were just disintegrating before our eyes and not realizing how close the threat of ISIS was. And then the invasion of ISIS in 2014 is what prompted me to think this is a story that has to be told. these are people whose lives need to be accounted for.
Well, and you told their stories, and I'm going to get you to tell mm-hmm. some of that here in our conversation. But one of the things that I thought was interesting about the book, and of course, I think it'd be interesting to people who don't know you. I mean, I know you, and it was, I think, particularly interesting to me and others who do know you or maybe who feel like they know you because of your long editorship at World, was that this was not just their story. In some ways, it really was your story. I mean, it was in some ways kind of a memoir, wasn't it?
It was, and it didn't start out that way. And actually, there were a lot of sort of hard conversations with my agent and publisher because they kept saying, we need to hear more of you. And what I came to see is that the sort of the entry point into this story, into this place that many of us think of as exotic, we think of the Middle East and we think people who are always fighting each other, always blowing each other up, and always at war. And so trying to tell just the story of their lives day to day, and especially to focus on what was happening to the Christians, meant having to recognize how I came to be interested in this, because I started out even as an international reporter, as someone who had studied international affairs in college. I started out as someone who wanted to cover anything but the Middle East. And after 9/11, it became clear that that wasn't going to be possible. And the Middle East was demanding that we cover it and that we understand it better. And so it did become somewhat my story, and it did become a personal story, because the people that I grew to know in Iraq became like brothers and sisters.
Well, that I want to drill down a little bit more on that memoir piece of it before, again, we get into the folks. But I know because I worked at World for a long time. I mean, there's a very, very high value in reporting. And even though, you know, you write opinion pieces for World, Marvin writes opinion pieces for World, the editorial page is not often first person. I mean, we, you know, there's a little bit of that, I don't want to say ironic distance, but a certain journalistic distance.
Right.
Was that hard? Was that?
It was very hard. I mean, we've been schooled in keeping a journalist distance. One of the reasons that I've been able to cover war zones, going into Sudan, going into Bosnia during the war there, and then going to Iraq and later Afghanistan and back to Iraq, is that reporter's distance. I recognized I was there for a very specific purpose. So that if I was looking at an 18-year-old whose chin had just been blown off, which I did on my first reporting trip into Iraq after the war, I needed to be covering what the nurses were doing. I needed to be looking at his uniform and how they were slicing it off to do surgery and those kinds of things. And I needed to keep my emotions in check. And so in a way, I mean, writing the book was a little bit like reliving all of it, because the emotions needed to come into play. And I had to tap into some things that had happened and where I was present, but I hadn't covered them in quite the same way, tapping into the human dimension and the personal stories.
And so you did that in part, as you say, by following these people over time from 2003 to 2014, 11-year period. Is that mm-hmm. more or less got that right?
That's right.
And tell me about some of those people. Tell me some of those stories that are not all of them, obviously, but just a couple of the people that you followed kind of from beginning to end.
Well, the first and for me, the person that I've grown closest to who's featured prominently in the book is Insaf Safu. Insaf and I met by phone in 2003, shortly after the U.S. invasion. A friend who put us in touch with one another thought that it would be good for me to accompany her when she went back to Iraq. As I got to know her, I thought that would be a good idea too, because Insaf had been a refugee forced out under Saddam Hussein along with her husband, and was going back for the first time. And so she was sort of emblematic to me of all these Iraqis who were returning at that time with great hopes for what the U.S. was going to bring to Iraq, this new Iraq that everyone was talking about. And I did fly in with her that first time in 2003. But I began to continue going back and either going with her or meeting up with her at some point along the way, because her story was so fascinating to me. And it is, you know, I think as I say in the book, it's through Insaf that I became sort of an accomplice to what was happening to the Iraqi Christians. One of the first things she did was she asked me to carry money across the border. And, you know, that's just a huge no-no for a reporter or just about anyone. And yet I was so compelled by what she was doing with that money and by just her one woman show that she represented and continues to represent, that I ended up, I put some of the money in my pocket and we went through security and got into Iraq. And that began this long road with her to watching her serve people, grow ministries in Iraq and continue to persevere in the midst of all kinds of destruction.
Well, I want to fast forward, or at least I want to continue the story, but and I'm trying to keep it in chronological order here. But I do wonder, you're writing the book now in 2014, 2015, or even, I guess, mm-hmm. maybe a little early 2016, maybe the final edits. And, you know, you're going back to 2003 writing about these incidents there. And as you said, there was this moment of great hope, right, where Saddam Hussein had been toppled, where there was this idea that maybe that, Iraq could be the second great democracy in the Middle East mm-hmm. after Israel even.
Right.
And as you say, you became accomplice in her activities, but in some ways, I'm wondering if you looking back on the reporting that you did then, if you feel in any way like you were an accomplice in that narrative that America was doing a great thing and there was this beautiful nation
right.
building happening there, or whether you felt like you even then kept your distance appropriate.
Well, yes and no. I mean, reporters have to operate in the field that they find themselves, and yep. the conditions in 2003, 2004 are very different than what we see happening now in the Middle East. And obviously, hindsight is a great thing, and we can look back and see just where and how we made so many mistakes in the way that we managed our time in Iraq. So, yes, I was hopeful, like so many people were. And keep in mind that it was a matter of months after 9/11.
Right. Yeah.
And the world was with us. That's a really big thing. As you know, we went to Iraq with the support of 30 some countries who were even putting men and women and armaments on the ground alongside with us because everyone thought that this was the right thing to do at that time. And I think, you know, particularly what intrigued me was learning about this diversity of Iraq, which I didn't appreciate, and learning this history of not only Christianity, but Judaism and so many other ethnic and religious groups there. Those minority groups were particularly the ones who felt like the U.S. invasion represented a new day for them, that they would finally have representation, that they would finally have newfound freedoms and be able to worship freely and live freely and run their businesses freely. It's a myth that things were better under Saddam Hussein, because every Christian I taught to in those early years had been jailed or somehow harassed under Saddam Hussein. He was not a person who was friendly to the church. He may have protected it for his own interests, but he wasn't. So yes, I went in with that same kind of enthusiasm and really sort of the eagerness to report on what would happen and how hopefully these institutions, religious institutions, Christian institutions would grow in this new Iraq. And of course, we all know now that what happened was just the opposite.
Well, yeah, but looking back, do you feel like it was a mistake for us to go into Iraq in the first place?
That's a hard question, because I think I still agree. And I would, there are a number of prominent journalists and policymakers who would still say this, that we went in for the right reasons. We had a legitimate reason to think that Saddam Hussein not only was making weapons of mass destruction, but was intent on using them and selling them to terror groups and conspiring with terror groups. I think we had a basis for saying that. I think that Saddam Hussein was plainly a menace. He had thwarted every UN resolution, every U.S. resolution, every international barrier that had been put in his way. However, the idea of staying there, I think we were all surprised in 2004 when it turned out we weren't going to liberate the place and turn it over to the Iraqis and leave. I think that's what I thought going in. But the fact that we stayed and the fact that we allowed ourselves to become embroiled, we really became sort of a sitting target for foreign terrorists to come in and to recruit. And we still are paying the price for that. So that's where I would say early on, the whole thing went wrong.
You're listening in on my recent conversation with Mindy Bells. We're discussing her new book, They Say We Are Infidels, On the Run from ISIS with Persecuted Christians in the Middle East. I'm Warren Smith. More with Mindy Bells when we return.
Hi, I'm John Stone Street, the president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and I'm delighted that the Colson Center is now the lead sponsor for Listening In. The Colson Center exists to inform, equip, and unite believers, and that's why we're delighted to unite with World to bring this informative program to you, a program designed to better equip you for the work of the gospel. To learn more about the Colson Center and our Breakpoint radio and podcast ministries, please visit us at breakpoint.org. That's breakpoint.org.
Welcome back. I'm Warren Smith, and today you're listening in on a recent conversation I had with author and journalist Mindy Bells. Let's get right back to that conversation. Mindy, we were talking about a trip that you made in 2003, but you had also made a previous trip in 2002, both trips soon after 9/11. This idea early on of great hopefulness that we had toppled Saddam Hussein, that there was a possibility for the Christian church to flourish. Right. In that part of the world, now that they weren't under the thumb of Saddam Hussein, at what point did you begin to get a sense that that ain't happening, that whatever flourishing that we might have hoped for was in fact not only not happening, but there was tremendous persecution right. that was actually starting to build up and that Christians were dying?
Unfortunately, it was soon after the invasion, but I would say in particular in 2005, when I got a call telling me that one of the pastors I had met in Baghdad, really dynamic man named Maher Dakhal, that he had disappeared along with five of the lay leaders of the church in Baghdad that he had helped to reopen. And they were returning across a desert from Jordan and their car just simply disappeared. They were never found. Their car was never found. People thought they'd been kidnapped and there would be a ransom demand coming. And there never was. And that was devastating to that particular church that had grown quickly under his leadership. It doubled and quadrupled in size and suddenly had no leadership. That was sort of a signal to the Christians, not sort of, it was a signal to the Christians that they were in danger and they were being targeted. And that was followed in 2006 by Sunday afternoon bombings in three different locations, three different cities in Baghdad and Mosul, clearly coordinated, clearly meant to attack these churches at a time when they would be meeting and they would maximize casualties. The bombing in Mosul and one of the churches in Baghdad were particularly gruesome. And that, too, was a big warning sign to the churches that they were not simply caught up in the violence, they were the targets of it.
Mindy, I wanted to pause for a minute in that narrative and just ask you about these Christians. I mean, I've not traveled nearly as extensively around the world as you have, but I will tell you my own bias is that, you know, I've been to, you know, places like India and I've been to, you know, South America and other places in Europe, for example. And especially in places like India, and I don't know why, I mean, again, this is probably bias or racism of some kind, you know, on my part, is that their Christianity is not like our Christianity. You know, it's this sort of weird cultural
amalgam. Not as sophisticated, not as free.
Exactly. Yeah, all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. And then, I go to India and I, you know, meet Christians there and realize that they take scripture very seriously, that they take doctrine very seriously, that they're deeply committed to a lot of the same distinctives that I'm committed to. And by the way, they've got this enormously rich spiritual life, you know, yeah. Personal, right. You know, spirituality that just really embarrasses me. And when I compare my own to it, and I'm wondering what your experience was like with the Christians in the Middle East. What flavor were they, if you will?
Well, they are many flavors, and I think I went in to Iraq with all those stereotypes. You know, that the old churches were fusty and out of date, and probably bigger on form than on content in their teaching. And over time, I learned how much of that was where I was mistaken. You know, and there is real historical precedence for this. And it's really fascinating. The Eastern Church was early on divided from the Western Church. There was the dispute that we won't go into, but over the Nicene Creed. And even though you had early church fathers from Iraq, largely organized church, let me say a highly organized church, even at that time, who were present when the Nicene Creed was adopted, there's this widespread feeling that that the church split off over that. But in fact, they were there and they signed on to the Nicene Creed, but they were divided in their church government. And so what that meant was that the Eastern Church grew up largely separated from a lot of the modernization, if you will, that came along in the Western Church. So I'm going to meet with various bishops and heads of the Chaldean Church and the Orthodox Church and different churches in Iraq the longer that I'm traveling there. And I'm discovering that they never lost the gospel the way that the church in the West did. They've held on to it. They, in fact, most of what they have was handed down to them, not from the Greek, and but from Aramaic. And it was translated from the language that Jesus actually spoke. And so some parts of the scripture, you can argue, they have in some ways a pure translation of it that they've held on to. I've seen the monasteries where they've very carefully tended those documents that date all the way back to the third century. And so it is, it's a fascinating, very different history than what we've seen in the West, some of the schism after schism after schism there. And so they do defy our stereotypes. At the same time, you've had this evangelical church that has grown up there. In some ways, you know, it has been supported largely by Western churches, but again, very evangelical. So this great variety of old and new belief, but very Orthodox belief in ways that would surprise you.
So you went there, you started going to that part of the world, to Iraq and other places in the Middle East, and you started developing these relationships, even when you weren't there, when you were back here in the United States doing your duty as the editor of World, those relationships nurtured your reporting, because all along you continued to report here from the United States and with occasional trips back. Developing these relationships with these Christians, you see the tide turning, though. You see some of your friends disappearing. Sort of pick up the story from there. I mean, at what point do you begin to realize that these are not isolated incidents? Yes, coordinated bombings, but coordinated bombings that kill 10 people, 20 people, 30 people, that's horrific, but it is not genocide. And at what point do you begin to realize that, wow, we might be losing the entire Christian presence in that part of the world?
Well, I think an early clue to what was happening came in 2008, trip that I made there in 2008, where I spent most of my time in Mosul and the Nineveh Plain area. Those are both areas that are considered sort of the heartland of Christianity. They were the heartland of Judaism in Iraq before, and Christianity naturally gravitated to those areas in the early centuries. What happened was, everyone was feeling the pressure of bombings and of terrorist activity, people were fleeing to these areas. The scattered villages of Nineveh Plain, very stark but beautiful rolling desert area, historic villages filled with churches and things like that. The Christians were naturally escaping to those areas. When we in the United States were talking about the surge and the success of the surge, and we were measuring that, and it was successful in terms of bringing control to areas like Baghdad and Anbar province. What was happening, though, was that the terrorists were being forced north, and they were regathering outside of Mosul, and they were regathering in Diyala province and Nineveh Plain. And what they began doing was attacking the Christians. And we began to see these areas that people had hoped would be sort of safe havens for them from the activities in Baghdad and other places, instead became places where the terrorists came and found them.
Well, and the terrorists were attacking Christians, and the defenders there were in part the Peshmerga. Is that accurate?
At that time, not so much. But what was happening was that further north, just north of Nineveh Plain, you have the area known as Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan, which is a semi-autonomous region at this point. and very strong government, very strong ethnic identity among the Kurds, and tremendous amounts of individual liberty. So you had churches operating freely. You had Christians being welcomed into the regional government for the most part, in that part, in contrast to the rest of the country. The United States, I mean, policy is important at this point because we are so focused on Baghdad and so focused in the on the Sunni-Shia divide and sort of managing that divide that we weren't taking advantage of what to me was perhaps one of our greatest assets for managing through this crisis and this level of terrorist activity in Iraq. In other words, we weren't using the Kurds as the allies that they were, and we weren't building on the example that they were setting in the north, where you have tremendous economic growth and tremendous growth, you know, tied to a growth in individual freedom.
Well, it's probably fair to say, too, or appropriate to say that the Kurds had also been, you know, really persecuted by Saddam Hussein. I mean, there are stories of chemical weapons killing, you know, right, tens of thousands, if not possibly even into the hundreds of thousands. Right. That number's in dispute of the Kurds. So the point is that, you know, anybody that toppled Saddam Hussein, they would view as an ally. So there was, I think, at least probably a natural tendency among the Kurds to think of Americans as their friends and someone that we could have used more effectively. Is that fair?
That's fair. And we didn't fully reciprocate that. I mean, we had given, you know, keep in mind before the war, we had protected that region with a no-fly zone. And that's what kept Saddam Hussein from wiping out the Kurds. And they were able to really do an amazing thing, build up their cities and create just an economic powerhouse there. The Kurds early on were attacking the terrorists, were bringing in some of the Al-Qaeda splinter groups that were coming in even before the U.S. invasion. They were saying to the United States, you know, we've got these people, what do you want us to do with them? And the United States was not responding. And we should have been. And we should have been working alongside them to we weren't taking the terrorist activity seriously. In other words,
why not? I mean, I'm not as nearly as expert in this as you are, but there are some really smart people. I mean, you know, obviously, folks like David Petraeus has been sort of discredited with, you know, with the scandal with Paula Broadwell and that sort of thing. But he's a really smart guy, and there are other really smart guys. Were they not seeing this? Were there political? Was it really so much a political issue in the United States that was causing this? I mean, Barack Obama basically got elected. One of the key planks in his platform was, we're going to stop fighting over there. We're going to bring our folks home.
Right. Well, there was so much infighting. You continually
infighting within
from between the State Department and the Pentagon, with the White House and the National Security Advisors, both under the Bush administration, and then continuing under the Obama administration. Though President Obama did come into office very clearly saying he was going to end this war. At the time, you know, I was in Iraq and I met with a group of Armenian. Actually, this happened in Syria. I met with a group of Armenian Christians who were all refugees. At that time, Syria was taking in a huge number of Iraqis and predominantly Iraqi Christians. And they wanted to know what was going to happen, because here we had prosecuted this war, but we had not made a way for people to continue living in their own country. And we weren't making a way for them to go back. And that has continued to be the theme of our adventure, if you will, in Iraq, is that we have come in, we've tried to achieve our own goals, but we haven't taken into consideration the people whose country it is.
And so the bottom line today, it's still pretty badly broken.
The bottom line today is that, you know, you have a situation in Syria where you have half of the country in Syria has been displaced, made refugees or homeless people. With that civil war directly related to the action that we took in Iraq. And you have a situation in Iraq where you have upwards of 2 to 3 million people displaced just simply in the north and by ISIS, and nearly the entire Christian population of Iraq. So this population that numbered about 1.2 million at the start of the U.S. Activity there in 2003, now numbers less than 250,000.
You're listening in on a conversation I had recently with Mindy Bells, the senior editor for international coverage with World News Group. She's also the author of a new book, They Say We Are Infidels, which recounts her more than a decade-long coverage of the war on terror in Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East. I'm Warren Smith. A final segment with Mindy Bells when we return.
Hi, I'm John Stone Street, the president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and I'm delighted that the Colson Center is now the lead sponsor for Listening In. The Colson Center exists to inform, equip, and unite believers, and that's why we're delighted to unite with World to bring this informative program to you, a program designed to better equip you for the work of the gospel. To learn more about the Colson Center and our Breakpoint radio and podcast ministries, please visit us at breakpoint.org. That's breakpoint.org.
You're listening in on a conversation I had recently with Mindy Bells. We had this conversation at World's headquarters in Asheville, North Carolina. Mindy, as we've already discussed, your book is in some ways a memoir, a personal journey of you going back over and over again and developing relationships with people that we're fighting against all odds, really. We're living, we're proclaiming the gospel, we're trying to live in the way the Bible, you know, called them to live against amazing odds. Stories of perseverance, I guess you could say. Say a little bit more about that. I mean, any stories stand out? I mean, we can't, you write the book to tell all those stories, and we can't do all of that. I mean, you know, obviously commend our listeners to the book, but it, one story in particular or two that stand out?
Well, it's striking to me, you know, obviously Muslims and Christians alike have suffered in Iraq and have suffered through these war years, and we don't want to minimize the suffering that Muslims have endured as well. At the same time, what gradually dawned on me, really, even in the course of writing the book, is that the Christians had actually been, and especially under ISIS, when they were forced out, they were specifically asked to give up their religion, to give up their belongings, and to leave. In other words, they left their homes, they left the city of Mosul, they left Nineveh Plain, because it was the only way that they could hold on to the one thing that mattered to them, and that was their faith. And so what they did was they did something that we hear talked about, that is, you know, the scripture is full of admonitions to leave father and mother and all these things that we saw Christ living, being a living example for. But they actually did that. They had, in some cases, they had to hand over the deeds of their property. And what they did was they fled in order to hold on to the one thing that mattered to them. And so you have this tremendous resilience and I think a clarity in that they have made a stand and said that the one thing they won't give up is their Christian faith. And if that means losing their houses, if that means losing property, losing a homeland that has been a Christian homeland for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, they'll do that. But they won't give up their identity as Christians and their commitment to following Jesus Christ.
Well, that's really remarkable. And, you know, you're telling these stories. And there are other organizations. I mean, you know, for example, you've worked with or at least quoted from folks in your reporting from Voice of the Martyrs and Open Doors and others that are operating that part of the world. But and I don't want to, you know, folks in my position often make too much of a cottage industry out of beating up on the church. And I want to be really careful not to do that. But it would it be fair to say that the American church has not been as sensitive, as aware, as responsive to the needs of our brothers and sisters in the Middle East as we need to be?
I'm amazed, as long as this issue has been going on, and it's been something that's been part of news headlines now for a decade or more, I'm amazed at how many Christians I meet in places I go where people say they don't understand what's going on, or I just can't follow that, or I just and I don't know what that is. There's our own people there. We've had a huge American presence there for a decade. That's now over. But we have had tremendous opportunities, it seems to me, to see and to understand what's happening to the Christians in this part of the world. And yet we feel like it's something that's beyond us as Christians. And what that has done is leave to this really small and really heroic group of aid workers and church workers and others to do this heavy lifting in this vast, vast humanitarian crisis. And so it's tragic in a way that, I mean, the church in the U.S. has missed out on an opportunity to really learn and grow from these people who have demonstrated such a great testimony. And also, obviously, the church in the Middle East has missed out on our help. And I think it's going to be very difficult to repair what's happened. I think it's going to be very difficult to find a way for many of these Christian families to return to their homes. As I said before, even their deeds are gone. So how you do that is going to be a really big question. Iraq and the Middle East will look like a very different place. I think we can have confidence that God is doing something and working in the midst of this, and we can keep looking for what that is. But I think that the church in the United States has missed a moment where it could have come alongside in a very big way these suffering Christians and could have, in a massive way, stood with them politically, stood with them on a humanitarian basis.
First of all, let's stipulate for the record that what you just said is true and that we've missed a huge opportunity. Let's also stipulate for the record that it's never too late to do the right thing. What would that look like now?
I think it would look like it has to happen on multiple levels. There, you know, I am amazed by some of the churches that I do know about that have done amazing things, churches that have stepped in and bonded with one church group that met an Iraqi pastor via Facebook, formed a relationship with him, sent people over, met with him, saw the needs there, came back, reported to their congregation. Out of that, put together enough money to rent most of an apartment building to house some of these displaced people. I mean, there are ways that churches have come alongside, just not in a big way. So there are those kinds of efforts that are very possible. And then at the macro level, I mean, putting pressure on political leaders to take this issue seriously, that our foreign policy shouldn't only be looking at propping up the next strong man to keep law and order in a place that we care about, but it ought to look at taking care of being true to who we are as Americans, taking care of minorities, and making sure that the disenfranchised have a seat at the table. Those are things that we have to press in our own political process here. And it's messy and it's dirty, but it has to be done. And when it's not done, people suffer and they die as a result.
Well, Mindy, I wanted to just explore, kind of go down a little rabbit trail, I guess you could say, for a minute, because something happened, an interesting interaction between you and me when you made one of these trips to Iraq, and that is that, you know, I pocket called you. You know, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have had the experience of pocket calling you. And, you know, and I didn't realize I'd done it until your voicemail came on, and I could hear your voice in my pocket, and so I pulled it out, and oh, gee, sorry, and I hit the end call button. But a minute or two later, you texted me back saying, did you call? And I, you know, texted you back mm-hmm. and said, pocket call, sorry. And then you said something along the lines of,
I was standing on top of the roof of one of the empty churches in Nineveh Plain when your call came. And great, great cell phone reception, by the way. But this was a vast area of Nineveh Plain that had been overtaken by ISIS. The villages had all been empty. But the Kurdish Peshmerga had fought back ISIS in those early days in 2014 and actually recaptured several of these villages. This was not far at all from where the America and the Navy SEAL, who was killed just earlier this year, not far at all from where he was killed. I was actually in the village where he was at the time that that happened. So greatly, you know, standing essentially at the front lines of ISIS, we could see their flags in the distance.
Well, it's just in some ways that episode was kind of to me, I don't know, an emblem and of just kind of the surreal nature of this whole thing where, you know, I could be sitting here, you know, literally at my home in Charlotte, North Carolina, and accidentally call you and you're standing on the front lines of, you know, the war on terror. And it occurred to me then what you probably experienced a lot in writing this book and in covering it, where there was a certain surrealism or an unreality to what even here in the United States, some of the military leaders have started calling the push button war, where, you know, we're, you know, flying drones over Baghdad out of, you know, an office building in Scottsdale, Arizona or something like that. And then, of course, I know what was going on in your life, too, was that a lot of listeners to listening in, regular listeners will remember interviews that I did with Kara Tippetts, who died of cancer a couple of years ago or a little over a year ago. You were very close friends with Kara.
That's right.
Your mother died in the midst of writing this book.
That's
as well.
Right.
You dedicated the book to your mother.
Right.
There was this, I mean, there must have been sort of this weird thing going on in your head. And again, I don't want to put words in your mouth or, and there's a question in here somewhere about just, you know, all the death over there and then dealing with death on a very personal level in your own life.
Well, I think that the lesson there is that you can't compartmentalize. And I think that's a really important lesson for all of us, but even for our policymakers, that, you know, push button wars still kill people and still change and affect lives. And so I'm standing on the top of a church and I'm hearing the F-18s fly over. And I'm realizing that the reality of that for the Iraqis living there is, will I be able to go back to my home? Will I ever be able to put a roof over my kids' heads again in their lives? Those are real questions. Those are real hardships and dangers and mortal dangers that they have faced. They're not remote, even though they might seem remote for us. And it's been interesting to me in trying to write a book that covers, you know, not only the 12, 14-year history of what's happened to the Iraqi Christian church, broadly speaking, but also what happened in my life. In my life during the time that this book covers, my four children grew up and graduated from high school. Two of them got married. My mother moved into my house and got very sick, and she died just a few months ago. That's one of the reasons that I dedicated the book to her, because she was very much part of this process of writing the book. And, you know, real life has a way of blending and teaching us all, you know, pointing to some of the same lessons. My mother was incredibly brave and resilient, and every day taking her to radiation in the midst of writing about what was happening in Iraq, I was reminded by her of just the example of the resilience of the Christians in the Middle East. They were the same traits. I was seeing them lived out in my home even while I was trying to write about them overseas. And so I think that there is this tremendous, stories have a way of building empathy, building just our appreciation for the human condition, the fallen world that we live in, and hopefully breaking down the barriers that prevent us from coming alongside of one another and helping one another through this often difficult and complex and life of danger that we face. It is everywhere we are mortal, and everywhere we all face tragedies and hardships and the loss of loved ones that people here in the United States can relate to ought to help us think about what the Iraqis are going through and losing so much in such a short time.
I'd like to get a little bit of a final update on some of the folks that are in the book. I mean, you know, I know the way the book process works is that you did most of the writing, you know, a year or more ago, and even the final editing where you were able to do some updates. Anything new happened with some of these folks?
Well, this has been a huge challenge with this whole process. And that is that, you know, I was having to go back and write about things that happened 10 years ago as a new crisis was unfolding in Iraq in 2014 and 2015. And that since I had to sign off and put to bed a book that I knew was a story that wasn't finished. And so since that time, we have seen some of the villages, some of the places that we've talked about, some of the towns that were taken over by ISIS. We're now seeing what ISIS is doing there. They are slaughtering Christians. They massacre of a village in Syria just a couple of weeks ago, where 43 families were killed overnight. I don't think we know the extent, and that's something that is really drawing me to this again, that we don't know the extent of the human damage, the human toll of ISIS at this point. We know that 5,000 women and girls are still in ISIS captivity. That to me is just a daily haunt that is happening and that we aren't doing more to free those women and children. And yet at the same time, some of the people in the book, people like Insaf, Insaf is just back from spending several months there doing what she's always been doing, which is helping to organize women's ministry, helping to empower women in the churches that are still active in this part of the world to help those who are displaced and those who've been made homeless by ISIS. She's very active in trauma counseling right now, which is a very, obviously a very big need for these families that have escaped being held by ISIS. A number of the pastors who are covered in the book are continuing to build schools, serve the displaced, and are now seeing a lot of new opportunities to serve not only displaced Christians, but displaced Muslims and displaced Yazidis, because the need is just so great. And so if Christians are willing and able to step up in the middle of that need and willing to risk what it takes, they find that the needy are coming to them and that there's just a wonderful door and opportunity for ministry right now.
That brings to a close my conversation with Mindy Bells. After serving for more than a decade as World's editor, she's recently moved to the role of senior editor in charge of World's international coverage. Her new book is They Say We Are Infidels, On the Run from ISIS with Persecuted Christians in the Middle East. Listening In comes to you from World News Group online at WNG.org. Listening In is just one of the many benefits of World membership. To find out more about becoming a member of World, go to GetWorldNow.com. Our technical producer is Rich Rossell. Our executive producer is Nick Eicher. I'm your host, Warren Smith, and you've been listening in.